Has there been someone in your career who either provided you a foot in the door or just dependably ran alongside you as your feet learned to pedal? For me, things really changed when I read a book written by John Spolstra. To sports executives, John's known as a disruptor, then an innovator, as well as an inspiration to leaders, including his son Eric Spolstra, coach of the NBA's Miami Heat. I was John's and his partner's first hire for their small sports marketing firm back in the early 90s. In this episode, I reflect back with my mentor, who would later motivate me to launch GameFace. Here's John Spolstra, my former boss and the sage of sports marketing. And John, it is so good to see you again. Even though I think you're trying to fool us here, you're not really in Maui right now, are you?
How do you know? The bad thing about Maui, they closed down two of my favorite golf courses.
Oh.
So well, all the golf courses in Oregon are open.
Okay. Well, yeah, I think our viewers are probably pretty familiar with your background. We're in the Zoom generation now, but you look great. It's so kind of you to join me here for GameFace Execs podcast. And as people who watched my first episode know, I really owe so much of my career to John Spolstra, to you, my friend. And you and I have not worked together in many, many years, but your influence has continued with me for decades now. And so I'm thrilled to be able to talk about what you do and the influence you've had on me and so many others, not only in the sports business, but in business in general and your writings, et cetera. But John, let's start off in sports because that's where you cut your teeth. That's where I did as well. And so as you look at the landscape of sports today with all that's going on, and as we're recording this interview, there are no fans to speak of in the stands. You made a name for yourself by putting fans in the stands. So as you look at the sports landscape, are you bullish or is this more of a bear market for sports as far as you're concerned?
I'm glad I'm not in it right now because there's a lot of scared executives. I think what sports needs right now is dynamic leadership more than ever before. And see, I don't agree necessarily without the no fans in attendance. I'm more concerned in Major League Baseball about the players because of the locker room and because of the dugout, because there is no social distancing there. But the St. Louis Cardinals, what they had, 11 or 12 people fall to COVID? Well, they came back 2 weeks later. I look at COVID by and large for these younger players as being like the flu. And you don't shut down the season or you don't stop the fans because of the flu. And in baseball, most of these stadiums are 50,000 seats. You mean to tell me that you couldn't put 15,000 fans in there with social distancing? So I think that there's a lot of scared executives, and I look at that there should be greater leadership. I think the leagues have to take the action so that the teams can perform.
Yeah. Well, John, you made, as the stories are told, you made your career being creative, innovative, and a word that you've liked to use over the years is outrageous. But could a young John Spolstra make a name for himself in this current climate?
Probably more so. I found, when I was writing Marketing Outrageously, I did a little bit of research on myself. And I found that my greatest successes came when the economy was the worst. Hmm. Now, it's not that I didn't do well when the economy was going good, but everybody did good when the economy was doing good. But when the economy was going bad, or like during this pandemic, there's a lot of people that are ducking. There's a lot of people that are hiding under the covers and waiting for this to pass by. And then they'll emerge and try to be great. My feeling is now is the time to really think outrageous thoughts. Now is the time to really be innovative. But I find, and I've talked to quite a few teams, they're just ducking. They're waiting for somebody to say, okay, the season is open, go ahead and sell tickets. And I don't think that this is the time to sit and wait.
Well, aren't they somewhat handcuffed by elected officials who...
Yeah, so that's where they've got, instead of just accepting that, they've got to go to politicking. If I could take a bunch of young people and put them in a three-month training program to sell tickets. Rob, I mean, you're a trainer. Can you imagine if you could take these young people and mold them for 90 days? And the cost would be very nominal because, remember, we hardly paid these people anything. So the cost would be nominal. And then when selling season opens, then you're fast on the shoot. And I said, that's what I would do, is I'd train these people. There's a book about the medical supply business. The guy's name is Williams. I forget the name of the book. But if you were into medical supplies, they would send you away to train for 9 months. I mean, I found that amazing that you'd go away to train for 9 months before your first sales call. In ticket sales, they train you for, what's a typical team train? If they don't hire you, if they didn't hire me or Steve DeLay.
Yeah, well, I was going to say, when I started in ticket sales, I got about 9 minutes of training.
So if you're a team where you know you're going to have a season, or you got to assume that there's going to be a season, this is such a marvelous opportunity to just really get good. Mm. And the opportunity costs are not that great. And you'd have the pick of the litter in hiring, right? I mean, you could pick, you don't have to worry about losing on the best candidates to another team. So that's the approach that I would take. And I would think that when the dust settled and you're selling tickets, that, yeah, if I was doing that, that would be outrageously successful.
Yeah. Well, I want to talk about that book for a second. Your best-selling book that you've had, and you're a prolific author. You've written several books. The one that seemed to get highest on the charts was Marketing Outrageously.
Right.
Before that book, though, was Selling Ice to Eskimos.
Right.
Or Ice to Eskimos, excuse me. And those two books, one's about marketing, the first. The other one's about selling. I want to ask you, let's hear it from John Spolstra. What is the difference? Because you also used to teach in university, John. You're an adjunct professor at the University of Portland. So give us the textbook answer. What is the difference between sales and marketing?
Well, marketing is, I look at it, the positioning of your brand, of your product. And the selling is actually going out and selling it, whether it's face-to-face or with a TV commercial or whatever. But the marketing is shaping that brand, but then handing it off to the sales staff to go out and sell it. That's the simple version of what I think it is.
And then if you were to have one of those titles, on your tombstone, which one would it be? Are you a marketer, John, or are you a salesperson?
Well, I think it's sort of like which comes first, the chicken or the egg, which comes first, marketing or selling. Mm-hmm. You know, my feeling is if you really study marketing and come up with a better product, it's easier to sell. So if you're selling and you have a bad product without the marketing, it's really, really difficult. Mm. So like when I went to become the president of New Jersey Nets, that was a bad product because the team was losing. Guys were ending up in jail. It just really wasn't a great environment. So the marketing there was, you couldn't sell anything. The marketing helped us sell because we positioned ourselves, how can we get sellouts? And we took the strategy of taking the best opponents, Michael Jordan, Boston Celtics, and tried to sell those games out. And then we started to get some traction off of that. And so the marketing helped us. Otherwise, those salespeople were just going to get killed. And marketers don't necessarily have to be good salespeople. They have to be good tacticians. They have to know strategy. Salespeople sometimes or oftentimes are really bad marketers, but boy, they can sell.
Your latest book that came out in July of this year, Get Your Ideas Approved. It's already being bought up all over the place. For those who have not read it yet, is there one or two skills or ideas that we can expect to walk away from having devoured that book?
The best way of putting it is, if you have an idea, just go up to your boss and say, hey, I've got this idea. Generally, that's routinely tossed aside. And I'd say, if you've got this idea that you really want to run with, and you want to present it to your boss, present it as if your boss was the Supreme Court. And if you fail, you're going to be locked up in jail for the rest of your life. How much would you prepare then if you're going to the Supreme Court? How much would you prepare that idea? And it's a lot different than going up to your boss saying, hey, I've got this idea. That almost routinely fails, I've got this idea. But if you go there, if you prepare as if you're going to the Supreme Court, which is not as daunting as you think, but you have to have that mentality first, then I'm going to say this boss isn't going to easily approve what I want to do. And let me tell you, I've had some boss like the New Jersey Nets. There were seven of them. And I presented things to them, which they approved. Now, they might have all seven approved it for a different reason, but they approved it, but it took... They were my Supreme Court at the time.
Well, the...
And it only cost $2.99, which is what I wanted to do. Yeah. And it was only, I think it was only 80 or 90 pages, Rob, but then to print it, print on demand, you need with Amazon, you need 100 pages. So I didn't want to just add fluff to it. So I added several chapters from Marketing Outrageously. Thinking, okay, this is an idea of how to get things approved. Here's some ideas.
Well, you also, which I don't think a lot of people know, at least those in the sports industry, you're also a real fan of writing thrillers.
Right.
At least two thrillers that are also on Amazon.
Right.
Where did that come from? Where was that always been? Is that
well, it
been
comes from all the traveling I did.
Okay.
You know, because as much as I would like to read business books, all the traveling I did, I'd read thrillers. And so at one point I just thought, well, maybe I'll try one. Hmm. And they're still selling decent. And they're getting good reviews. So I've got another one that I'm going to work on this winter.
Cool. Well, we can't wait to hear about that one. Now, John, the book, though, that I believe was your best was, I think, your first. Now, that's not to say your other books aren't fantastic,
right,
but I'm speaking selfishly and personally here, because that book was this one here. I'm holding it up for those of you watching on YouTube.
Right.
Now, this is volume two of How to Sell the Last Seat in the House.
Do you have all three volumes?
Of course I do. Okay. I just wasn't going to hold all three up. So, yes, this book, How to Sell the Last Seat in the House, you wrote based on your experience being the president of the Portland Trailblazers. You didn't start as the president, but you moved into that position. And you created a sellout streak during the 80s and 90s. Which was unheard of at the time, when the team was good and not so good. But this book, How to Sell the Last Seat in the House, for those of you who are listening who are not from the sports industry, I will just tell you, I have to attest that this was the Bible of sports marketing back in those days. Not that it shouldn't be today, but unfortunately, I don't think as many young people are aware of it, and it may not be taught in university like it should be. I grabbed this book when I worked for the LA Clippers, and I began reading it, and I devoured it. Now, this is volume two. There's two other volumes, volume one and three as well. And John, you got to tell everybody, how much did it cost someone to buy How to Sell the Last Seat in the House?
$800.
Well, no, $795.
Oh, okay. Right.
I remember.
It wasn't meant for everybody.
No.
But there's three volumes, and it was, there had, up to that point, Rob, there had never been anything written about ticket marketing or sales. Not even an article, because there wasn't any trade journal at that time. But there's nothing about ticket sales. And of course, there wasn't Google, so you couldn't look online for ticket sales. And we had been pretty successful at selling tickets. And there are some teams in the NBA who I thought just had no clue of selling tickets. A lot of teams at that time didn't have a clue. They've become a lot more sophisticated. And so I thought, I just should write this down. A primer, A to Z, this is how you sell tickets. And I think, you know, there's 400 teams that bought it.
Yeah.
At $795.
Yeah. It wasn't a book written for consumers. It was,
right.
It was written for business executives within that industry.
You know, fast forward, when I retired, it was about 8 or 9 years ago, I've been getting people saying they lost volume two or they lost volume three.
I have volume two here.
Yeah. And I've been thinking, you know, I should update this thing, except that updating it wasn't that easy because everything, things electronically had changed, all these innovations. Hmm. So I was talking to Steve DeLay, who Steve I hired at the New Jersey Nets and then at Mandalay. And I said, you know, I'd like to update this. I said, you know it as well as I do, the books. So if you want to go 50-50 and work on this, I'm willing. And so that's where we came up with the Ultimate Toolkit, which is essentially taking that 20 years forward and using a lot of the innovations that we did at New Jersey and Mandalay, a lot of things that weren't available back at the Trailblazer days in the 80s.
And then there was a second run at producing a three-volume book because the industry was crying for more information. So then you put out this book,
right.
The Profits Are Brought to You By, a book about how to sell sponsorship.
Right.
The big ticket items. Now, this also came in three volumes. As you see, I've got volume one in my hands right now. How much did this cost, John?
That was $1,600, I think.
That's right. It was $1,595. That's right. Now, one reason I know about this is as I was devouring these books, I got a call from your business partner, Doug Piper, in 1993. I was working at the LA Clippers. I was a ticket sales manager there. And Doug invited me to come interview with the both of you up in Portland to join your, at the time, two-person
firm. Was it 1993?
Yeah, it was 93. And so the funny thing about it is, long story short, you and Doug hired me. You hired me to sell these books to teams throughout the country, even internationally. And the funny thing about that, John, is that I arrived in Portland, Oregon, where you were based. And I think I started on July 1st, 1993. And I get to the door of SRO Partners, and there's a note on the door. And it's from Doug, who says that he's on the road and you're off to New Jersey. And and he told me to go across the hall to another suite and I'd get a key from them. I walked into this new office with another note on my computer and my little desk saying, with a list of teams to call. And you basically both told me, just knock them dead, Tiger. Start selling these books.
Well, that was the heavy training that we provided.
But
Without doing that, that wouldn't have led you into developing training for teams.
I guess so. That's right. So I am forever grateful that for your negligence.
Because I was off then to be president of New Jersey Nets.
That's right. So the timing was impeccable because you hired me, and as soon as I said yes, you left. Because I said yes, I don't know. But yes, now I want to ask you about some key principles from these books. I'm going to just use the ticket book, the How to Sell the Last Seat in the House. Again, it changed the way I looked at the industry and what I should be doing, as it did for hundreds of organizations. And I had the privilege of being probably your first disciple out in the industry, because I was telling people about the goodness found in these books and then how it would revolutionize their sales. And then you allowed me to go out and Doug as well, to go out and provide seminars in your name, teaching these teams how to implement the contents of the book. I want to share with you three principles or ideas that really stuck out for me. And I want to ask you, for our listeners and viewers who are not in sports, how would these ideas be applied to any industry? So here's the first. You talk about the importance of sellouts versus the importance of raising your average attendance.
Right.
How does that principle apply to a tech company or to a retail store?
Let's take a tech company. What I find with different companies is sometimes they try to sell a full product line. But with every company, they've got some dog products. And they're blessed if they have some really cool products. So my feeling is that, and they spend an inordinate amount of time often selling the dog products that nobody really wants, and trying to manipulate those products and forsaking, but my feeling is you should spend most of your time and most of your effort on your good products, marketing them. And if the poor products don't sell, don't even worry about it. Because generally, you know, the 80-20 rule applies to products too. And the 80% of your profits or sales come in from 20% of your products, and vice versa. So I would concentrate on that. So like what we looked at was sellouts. And like New Jersey, that was the perfect test tube for that. Was why in the world, when I got to New Jersey, they had 7 straight years of being the worst team in the NBA. They had 7 straight years of being worst team in attendance, sort of figures. They led the league in drug rehab cases. They were not a favorite team in the New York area. That was the New York Knicks. But the New Jersey Nets played the New York Knicks, and the Knicks were sold out. So if you wanted to see the Knicks, you had to come to us. If you wanted to see the Boston Celtics with Larry Bird and that team, you had to come to us. And that's what we did. The product that we had is we played somebody. My feeling is with almost any product, any company, spend the time on your best products and don't get worried about not spending time with your also-ran products.
I remember in the book, and again, I know the book, I think, as well.
You probably know it better than I do. you sold it. I just wrote it.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I just remember one of the examples you give in the book is so many teams will have, let's say, an owner who's very concerned about that low attendance game that's coming up on Tuesday night next week. And so they encourage, or in fact, they insist that their executive team and their sales team and their marketers just put a bunch of energy and money into filling up that game. And so all of that effort, all of those resources could be spent. And in the end, you maybe bump up your attendance by 1,000 people.
Right. Nobody would know the difference.
Exactly. But you also point out, and this is a principle that I have tried to convey with attribution, I would add, to my clients, which is, look, people will remember being a part of a sellout.
Right.
They will not remember being a part of an average house.
Hey, Rob, with New Jersey Nets, I gave their 7 owners, I gave them a list of games that they couldn't go to. And the guy said to me, he said, wait a minute, I'm the owner. I can go to any damn game I want to go to. I said, you can't go to these games because we're going to ignore them. And it's going to be a lousy attendance. You're going to feel bad because there's nobody there. Yeah. But if nobody goes to the game, nobody knows that nobody went to the game. So I said, but for the big games, where are we going to sell out? Go to those games, have fun. Just enjoy the energy in the building. But for these lousy games, we're not there yet where we can start selling out off of our team alone.
And when they go to those games, they want to have that experience again and again.
Right.
So
right.
One sellout feeds the yet next sellout, yeah. So forth. All right. So principle number two. And again, I could pick two dozen principles from your books, but I'm just going to choose these three. Number two is you talk about in How to Sell the Last Seat in the House, the importance of packaging games. So in other words, instead of forcing someone to buy a complete season, which is either too expensive, too many games, inconvenient,
crazy
budget, you said no. At the Trailblazers and then at the Nets, you said, let's package games. And if they want a 5-game pack, let's sell them a 5-game pack instead of trying to cram something down their throat they don't want. So,
and in New Jersey, we put together our 5 best games. NBA teams at that time, if they did any packaging, would take 3 good games and 2 really crummy games. And they would sell 44 packages. We wanted to sell thousands because we wanted to sell out the building. In New Jersey, when I got there, in a 20,000-seat arena, they had 500 season tickets. So we had to go 19,500 every game to get a sellout, which, Rob, as you know, is not an easy task.
Yeah.
But so we put together our 5 best games, and one of the owners, when I presented to the owners, he said, that's too good of a deal for our fans. And I said, look, you've been providing crappy deals for your fans all these years, and they haven't bought. Let's fool them. Let's think that we made a mistake. We put together this great package, and that they better buy before we come to our senses. And so we did that, and we sold 25,000 of them. We had to roll it over into other games. And those games were just pure electricity. That's one of my great experiences in my life, was going to those games. I mean, it was really a lot of fun.
Yeah. Wonderful concept. Let me ask you one from your Profits Are Brought to You By, the sponsorship book. You really made a mark in the NBA by, if I'm not mistaken, John, you were the first executive that insisted that the Portland Trailblazers bring their media rights in-house.
Right.
Now, some people listening to this don't know what that means. So could you explain that? And then how does that same principle apply to business today, irrespective of industry?
Well, now they call it outsourcing. Businesses call it outsourcing. But back in 1980, when I started with the Trailblazers, every team in the NBA outsourced their radio. And they'd sometimes get paid by the radio station, or the station would pay some money for the right to broadcast the games. And to show you how the economics have changed, Rob, that first year with Portland, the year before I got there, the Trailblazers received a rights fee of $25,000. That was third best in the NBA. Third best, $25,000 a year. And I felt if we didn't outsource it, we did it ourselves and got the radio station at nighttime, where they make their money is morning drive and afternoon drive. So nighttime, it is relatively easy to get airtime from a radio station. And we brought it in-house. That meant that we'd have to pay for the announcer. We'd have to pay for the, for everything, pay for me, pay for my assistant. And that first year, instead of making, what we did was gamble the $25,000. And that first year, we made net $900,000. That was more than the rest of the NBA combined. So that was a shot heard around the world in the NBA, which that led to me getting traded the following year to the Indiana Pacers, because they wanted they wanted to capitalize on radio just like the Portland Trailblazers had. And Larry Weinberg, the owner of the Trailblazers, wouldn't let me go consult. And so when we lost a point guard, Darnell Valentine, to I think he broke his arm or hand. The Indiana Pacers called up Stu Inman, who was then the general manager, and said, look, we'll give you our starting point guard, Don Boozy, for 2 weeks of Spoelstra's time. And we did the deal.
First time in NBA history, maybe sports history, that an executive was part of the trade.
I think Indiana got the better part of the deal.
Yeah, good for you. And if my memory serves me, you didn't even go for the full 2 weeks, right?
Right. It wasn't that difficult philosophically about bringing radio in-house. And then interestingly, the Indiana Pacers were owned at that time by a business partner, Jerry Buss, the owner of the Lakers. I can't recall the guy's name right now. But he wanted to sell because he was losing money, as most of the teams in the NBA in those days were losing money. And one of the things they wanted me to do was meet with prospective owners, the affluent prospective owners, and then meet with these prospective owners and tell them that they didn't have to lose money if they owned the team. So I met with several of these owners that flew in. And then the last day, two guys walked in, and it was the Simon brothers, and they were local. They're from Indianapolis, Mel and Herb Simon, who they still owned. Like, well, Herb does. Mel passed away a number of years ago.
And then the idea of bringing something in-house as opposed to outsourcing.
Right.
You think that's still a good idea in today's world?
Depends. You know, like cable has changed the dynamics for everything. So cable companies really were spending big on rights fees. But the Yankees, in essence, brought cable in-house with the YES Network. They're making a fortune off that. The Dodgers that didn't, they didn't outsource, or they did outsource that, right? So I think it's a circumstance. You have to look at each circumstance. But at the time when we did it, by the way, it was not an easy deal. My boss fought me like crazy, saying this: we're risking the $25,000, and this is crazy. Nobody would want that. My feeling was, and I wrote about that in Get Your Ideas Approved, that I thought we could probably make a profit of about, let's say, a couple hundred thousand, 300,000. Because we had the advantage of selling sponsorships more than the radio station, because we are the team. We could do a promotion, we could do a player appearance, we could do a lot of different things. And it went better than I thought.
Well, to your point then, you as a taking it in-house meant that you were selling more than just a radio spot.
Right.
You were selling all the other promotion and signage, print advertising that comes with a sponsorship. Not to mention player engagement and things like that. Right. So you demonstrated that the value of a sponsorship for a sports team in those days was much greater than teams were getting for it.
Right.
And so you set that trend. You know, all of these ideas, John, it's really interesting to know about, you know, the early days of John Spoelstra. Let's just take a little bit of walk down memory lane. I wasn't with you, but I know enough about your background because we've been friends for so long and you've been my mentor. You come from a sports family in that your father, Watson Spoelstra, was a writer for the Detroit News. So right. He's a sports writer. He covered the Tigers. He covered the Lions. He covered the University of Michigan. Right. So you were always around the sports industry growing right. up. And I think you were more of a baseball guy, weren't you, when you were growing up?
Yeah.
Yeah. So you go to the Tigers games.
Like one summer, I think I must have gone to every Tiger game. You know, I might have been 13 or 14 years old. The Tigers in those days, baseball played a lot of day games. You know, it wasn't the Wrigley Field where they didn't have lights. It was just standard for baseball in those days to play a lot of day games. So my dad would take me down to the ballpark, and I had to run. He'd go down there about 2 hours before the game, and they would open up the gates about an hour before the game. So I had to run of the entire ballpark for about an hour. And I saw the Tigers batting practice. And one of the thrills that I saw was Gordie Howe, legendary player of the Red Wings. He would come out frequently to batting practice. And the opposing players would come out and watch Gordie Howe in batting practice. He would hit, you know, he's a big, strong guy. He had tremendous wrists. And he would come out. He'd hit one in the second deck in left, and he hit one in the second deck center field, which is 440 away, and then second deck right field. And these opposing players were just in awe, the Tigers were. But I would see him. I saw Ted Williams in batting practice. So, like, the only people that saw batting practice were the players and me, you know. So that was a great thrill. And that was the bond between my dad and myself, that until he died, we were always able to talk. We had a link that we had something we could talk about on a comfortable ground, and that happened to be the Detroit Tigers. Mm-hmm. Even when they had the lousy years, we could at least talk about that. Mm-hmm. And I thought the same thing with my son, Eric. There was a year when he was probably in junior high school where he came. We went to every Blazer home game. And in those days, traffic wasn't as great in Portland as it is now. So I could drive home from work, have dinner at home, and Eric and I would jump in the car and drive to see the game and drive home. In those days, a game would end in 2 hours. I mean, never went over 2 hours. So we'd be home in sufficient time where we didn't have to stay up late. And that was the link that we had. People have asked me about, did I have any intentions that he would go on? And I said, look, there's no way that you could plan that your son could become an NBA coach and be as successful as he's been, win two championships. I looked at it as a link between him and me, just like I did the link between my father and me. And that was baseball.
Well, and just to be clear, for those who may not be aware who are listening, Eric Spoelstra, whom John is speaking of, is, as John said, has gone on to become an NBA coach. He was never a player in the league. He was always in the coaching ranks. And he won two NBA championships. And it's impressive to see his rise. And John, I want to ask you, you talk about sports being that link. You had a successful relationship with your father. You and your son and your daughter, Monica, who is a very successful businesswoman, have great relationships. What are some lessons from someone who has been in sports his entire career, practically, who's raised his kids in the industry? What are some lessons you can teach those of us who are in the sports industry, raising children, trying to make it all work?
Well, I'm not sure it's the sports. I think if I was a plumber, if I was a carpenter, there's got to be that link. What common ground can you talk to kids with where they both sides freely want to talk, where it's not awkward, it's not, it's something that's a safe conversation, because growing up, bringing kids up, you've got to be able to have those conversations, because there's going to be some difficult conversations. And so if you don't have the safe ground to talk, when it comes to the difficult conversations, I'm not sure that they hear you. So I learned it from my dad that we could always revert back to talking about the Tigers. And then when there's a difficult conversation, we could just sort of ease into that. And I think the same thing with my kids.
And John, speaking of kids, you've also mentored many, many people in the sports industry. And there are a lot of cases of people that you've mentored who've gone on to leadership positions. So I've been wanting to ask you, when it comes to those people, did you just happen to come across good talent, or did you make good people talented?
Well, the best way to motivate people is hire motivated people. And then don't mess them up. So I felt I was pretty good at hiring young people. There are certain things I looked for in hiring young people, but I was really looking at imagination and work ethic. And then how do you bring them along? But I really wanted them to be able to work hard, and I just didn't want to mess them up. So, yeah, some of the people that I've worked with are tremendously successful. And at one time, in Sports Business Journal, they had the 40 under 40. I had three of the 40 under 40 in 1 year. Mm. And they've gone on to tremendous careers. And I'm really happy for them, and I've really enjoyed working with them. But one of them, Howie Neuchow, who's now co-head of CAA Sports, which is the largest representation agency, we hired him as a young ticket salesperson. This is at the New Jersey Nets, and it would have been circa 1991 or so. And he was dead last. We had 20 salespeople, which, Rob, at that time was unheard of, that you'd have 20 salespeople. I think it was 1992. Now, the 20 salespeople, he was dead last in sales. We fired the guy who was fifth best. And when the guy that was fifth best got fired, the sales manager fired him, but he came storming into my office and he said, "How come I got fired? I'm the fifth best. And Neuchow is around and he's the worst." And I told him, I said, "We fired you because you lie." And with every ticket holder that did not renew at the New Jersey Nets, I called them up personally, not to try to save them, but I wanted to find out why. And so if you call up people and you're trying to sell them, you're just really trying to find out why, I found out that this guy offered things that we could never deliver on. And it was like a player appearance or, different things like that. So he was able to make sales. The people didn't renew because we didn't deliver what he said we were going to deliver. And so I fired him. With Neuchow, I felt he always had these smarts. I felt that he had an innate ability to be able to talk to people that were the age of his father, but talk to them freely. He wasn't intimidated, but he was respectful at the same time. And I felt that he just was a little bit stubborn in learning our way of doing things. And so the second year, he became the second leading salesperson. And at that time, we had a staff filled with gunslingers. I mean, these guys were really getting good. And the third year, he became the top salesperson. So, and Howie's gone on to a terrific career, of which, coincidentally, he's my son's agent.
When we talk about the executives in sports today, what are some of the greatest opportunities they have? You talked at the beginning of this interview about, when times are down, that is when you have an opportunity to shine and be outrageous and creative. Are there any other opportunities that you see right now? And also, what are the risks associated with pursuing a sports career right now? Is this a time maybe to look at some other field of study or as an occupation?
Well, right now it's difficult to in any industry, except there's some that are really flourishing, because of COVID. But like golf courses are flourishing right now. Who knew before March that golf was considered a dying sport? And now it's flourishing like crazy. The golf sales are way up. Green fees are way up. Everything's way up in golf. So in the sports world, it, Robert, you know, the easiest way, the best way to get, if you're a young person getting into sports, is through ticket sales. And then hopefully while you get into ticket sales, you get trained by somebody, somebody good, like you or me or Steve, somebody that knows what we're doing. And hopefully you have a boss that believes in the training. And so if you're a young person and you have a good work ethic, I think that's the best place to start, because if you spend 2 or 3 years, 2 years in ticket sales, generally teams will hire from within for other spots on their staff, whether it be in marketing or promotions or whatever. So I think that's the best way still. Nobody gets hired in promotions from the outside, do they? I don't know if I've ever run into anybody.
No.
So
promotions, media relations, right?
Right. That's where they, but if you get it with the right team, it doesn't have to be the best team. It doesn't have to be the most glamorous team. Like the New Jersey Nets were nothing close to being glamorous. And yet take a look at the people that came out of that in the industry today. There's industry leaders throughout, but because we trained them hard. You know, one thing I did back then is I did this at Mandalay. Mandalay, I started to perfect it a little bit better, but in New Jersey, we had a week-long boot camp where the first two and a half days were just on how to get an appointment over the phone, an eyeball-to-eyeball appointment. And at Mandalay, when we had 7 baseball teams, we'd have, let's say, 50 salespeople of those 7 teams. We'd fly them all down to Texas. And we had a small town in Texas where we put them up at a motel, and we had a seven-day boot camp there. And they had to pass these certain benchmarks. And if every one of them didn't pass, we all had to stay and keep on going. So there's a lot of peer pressure to get better. And from that group, from the Mandalay group, there's a lot of leaders in our industry. So the training, if you're a young person, you get that type of training, you get the right team. I don't think it really makes any difference which sport. You're going to get your foot in the door, and I think that you'll have a career in sports.
Well, I think the other thing that I want to echo, you said it doesn't really matter which team or which sport. It's absolutely true, because it's amazing to me how many young people think that their first job is where they're going to retire.
Right.
I try to remind them, look, you're entering this industry. You could have a 40, 45 year career in this industry. Right. So I preach professional patience all the time, and don't think that your first job is going to be your last job, or your first role is going to be your last
role.
Right. So,
and they want to go to their favorite team generally.
Well, you know, there's an actor by the name of Charles Grodin. You remember him?
Mm-hmm.
Very funny, comedic actor. He used to be on Johnny Carson a lot. And he used to say, I never want my opportunity to come before I'm ready for it. Because he didn't want to blow it.
Right.
He wanted to get ready for that great
opportunity. That's sort of like my idea about the getting your ideas approved. You have to prepare as if you're going in front of the Supreme Court. The same thing here. If the opportunity comes, you got to jump on it.
But you got to be prepared for it.
Right.
Exactly. So, John, let's play a game here as we get near the end of our discussion. We're going to call it the 24-second clock. So okay. I'm going to give you 3 questions, and not within 24 seconds. You get as much time as you need for each of them. But I just want to get your immediate reaction to this. And this is... we're going to try to expand it now beyond the sports industry, but if you want to stay in sports, that's fine. So here's my first question for you. What team or company or organization, if you could right now for fun, if you could work with them, which one would it be? Name the brand.
Wow. I would say Major League Baseball.
Hmm. So what would you do with them? What would you do with Major League Baseball if you could work with them right now?
Well, I think I would have fans at the games. And I'd say there's no restrictions, no social distancing. But anybody over the age of 55, you can't come to the games. But we're going to buy you the equivalent of NBA League Pass, whatever they call the Major League Baseball one. We're going to gift you Major League Pass. So we want you to see the games. We want to see all the games. We don't want you to come to the games. But everybody else that comes to the games, you've got to wear a mask, and there'll be some social distancing. That would shake things up, wouldn't it?
Yeah. All right. Let me ask you a second question. Speaking of sports now, who is the best owner of a sports team today?
I would say Mickey Arison of the Miami Heat. Because they've had longevity. And Pat Riley's been there for 20-some years. My son's been there for 20 years. He doesn't have the knee-jerk reactions that a lot of owners have. And when I see some of these owners, like Sacramento, just fired Vlade Divac. But they've gone through a coach about every 18 months or so. They go through general managers. Come on. It's either you're really bad at hiring or you're really bad at managing. If you have to fire people that frequently. And so I look at stability. And it's one thing to have the stability if you're winning. It's stability if you're losing, perennially loser, but you just keep on the same people, then that's not good either. If you have good people, you got to pay them right. You got to do the right thing. I would say Mickey Arison, if you take a look at the NBA, he's been about as most solid as you can get. And the other sports, I just don't know the owners well enough.
Okay. Thank you. That's appreciate those insights on the Heat. Well, I really appreciate a little walk down memory lane with you, but also more importantly, I appreciate the insights and the wisdom that you've lent me and let the listeners of Game Face Exec. So this has been a great conversation, and so glad to know that you're still got your foot in the industry. You're still having an influence. We wish you and your family the best, of course. So thanks so much, John.
Thank you, Rob. This is fun.
It's been great to visit with you. I'm sure we'll do it again.
Thanks for being a part of this episode of Game Face Execs. If you found any of it useful or helpful, please rate or like and subscribe to our YouTube channel. I always appreciate you referring us to others as well. I'll see you next week. Until then, persuade, influence, inspire.